This is Cyber Defense Radio with your host and cybersecurity expert, Gary Malefsky. Gary brings to you another globally recognized cybersecurity executive in the hot seat today.
Sitting in my hot seat today is a very special guest, one of my favorite CEOs and co-founders of the coolest company. We're talking about Mario Folkeson, who is the CEO and co-founder of Reversing Labs. He deals with tomorrow's malware today, and it's hitting networks like you've never seen, and he's got some great stuff he's going to talk about. Mario, welcome back.
Thank you very much for welcoming me again, Gary. Pleasure being here.
And by the way, you are a Black Unicorn winner, which means our team of tough judges felt that Reversing Labs is going to be, in the near future, a $1 billion player in the market.
We are going to celebrate that moment. Believe me.
Can't wait. So tell us what you're up to now. I understand that malware labs are hot. What does that mean? Who's doing it? Why are they doing it? What's going on?
We are realizing that many organizations are having serious challenges in being able to respond to all the data that different control mechanisms in the organization are producing and are doing their finest and putting together open source, homegrown solutions that enrich them data, give them workflows, allow different tiers, of analysts to figure out what's right, what's wrong, what's false positive, what requires the incident response. And in this process, they tend to spend a lot more time building different solutions than actually looking at those alerts. And whenever you start missing the alert train, you're effectively failing in your ability to control or to verify the controls that you have built in your organization. It's almost yin and yang. You buy a lot of security solutions. How do you ensure that they're actually working? And this is why historically we have invested in SIEM solutions, in TIP, in SOAR, putting things together so that we can answer that question. If there is an exceptional event, if there's something unknown, will somebody react to first indicators of anomalous activity? We all want to avoid situations like with Target, where there was a lot of alerts, there was known activity, no one able to react, and no one seeing the activity to be able to properly react.
And so we've got team members in companies, large organizations, banks, government agencies, healthcare providers, insurance companies, big teams. And the team says, whether it's the red team or someone in the SOC, we can probably piece together our own malware analysis lab. The problem with that is they didn't piece together their own firewall with IP tables and Linux and 82 other components. They bought Palo Alto or they bought some other firewall. They went to Juniper, whoever that they liked, whether it's Speeds, Feeds, Performance, Fortinet, whoever, and they got their firewall or WatchGuard, all the players. These are companies that put millions and millions of dollars into R&D to develop the world's greatest of their kind of firewall. And there's a reason we buy these products from these vendors. You're the market leader at malware analysis. Why would I not want to buy a malware lab from you if it's turnkey?
It's your typical sort of build versus buy conundrum. And with all the new technologies, you always have advanced teams, and many teams have senior team members who like tinkering, like building things, which obviously if your job is to continually respond on the next to the next fire, having some time to build something is a really interesting distraction. I believe it's difficult for a lot of companies to keep up with that situation, because even if they're using a lot of open source componentry, integrated whole is highly proprietary, highly unique. And if that person is no longer interested, or is no longer in the organization, it becomes very painful to maintain it. And it's not the first time that this has happened. Historically, you just mentioned firewalls. People were in the 90s were building their own firewalls, even when there were commercial firewalls alongside. We've stopped doing that for sure. It's been 20 years later and we've learned something. But I still here and there run into organizations that are building their own SIEM solutions that are not relying on commercial SIEMs, figuring out that because they have a lot of database talent, lots of storage, they could always build a better contraption themselves. Now, 2 years later, 5 or 10 different team members fast forward, and a difference of problems arise. So we really see this as being evolution for many organizations. They tried on their own, sort of they're messing around with dynamic analysis solutions, install Cuckoo, somebody who knows what they're doing, they're fine with it for 3 months, and then they're suffering for a couple of years until there's, hey, how do we come up something that does dynamic analysis, but does also 50 other things that we need? Because I just don't need some mega maxi contraption where I don't even know what's working and what's not working.
So the good news is that companies are exploring this need. They now realize that they have to analyze the malware that's hitting their organization. Maybe it helps them pinpoint who's a real target. Are the receptionists getting hit with the most phishing attacks with the worst zero day? Is it designed to take over the CEO or the CFO's computer? Is it designed to do lateral movement across Active Directory? What's the purpose of the malware? It sounds like excellence in cybersecurity must be inclusive of proper malware analysis, but you can't do it properly if you're not using a well-designed malware lab. So tell us about what you are offering for these companies that they shouldn't build it themselves. What are you offering for? Give me a malware lab. How long does it take to deploy? What do I get when I deploy your malware lab?
So from our perspective, the deployment is rather straightforward, and we provide privacy forward-looking options that could be deployed on customer networks or different ways of hosted solutions, hosted in customers' VPCs, hosted by reversing labs as a sort of managed service. It really expands the gamut of, you know, what enterprises need. And the idea is really to provide a unified experience that has a best possible advanced static analysis, best possible collection of threat intelligence, so that enrichment could be a lot better than the different open source or free tool sets that companies usually put together, something that they could bounce against the signals they're getting from the field, from the security products that, you know, they're buying, which is the essential task for any analyst to verify. Is this a real incident, or this is something that we can easily close and say, we've looked at it, it's a false alert, move on. But the lab itself combines, you know, a lot of these sort of enrichment and then multiple level of analytics steps that bring a tremendous amount of threat intelligence, you know, around all sorts of indicators, you know, be it network indicators, be it, you know, file indicators, that put together a comprehensive picture of what an incident has looked like. Because usually there is not enough information. There's just sliver information. You may get in a few of these, the curated threat feeds. They may have a match. Usually they don't have the match, or you're dealing with, you know, type of an attack that's based out of JavaScript, Python, PowerShell, a document, or something that is never going to be able to detonate automatically. So meaning you really require a person to go and do something. So we put this together and connect it, you know, to resources that normally threat hunters would use. And obviously we're trying to put together the threat hunting versus threat analysis response together, because those teams naturally need to share data. And you have no idea how many teams have, you know, separate solutions. Data doesn't exist, doesn't persist. Oh, we were looking at that, I can't find it anymore. And effectively the tasks and investigations start from the beginning. And so Reversing Labs also provides a sort of dirty collection storage unit, which is really important. Most organizations really cannot have, you know, potentially malicious, unwanted content in their networks. It needs to be really put somewhere else into another solution that can be segregated and where security team lives. And security team teams historically have been the most infected teams, you know, to begin with, because like doctors, they work with dirty matter, and of course they're going to get infected, you know, one way or another. So combine that within a lot of advanced threat hunting experiences using Yara, Retro Yara, Euro, focused on your data, but also combining with tremendous amount of cloud-based, you know, data that we have. And we can say that we have the largest possible collection of binary content for threat hunting. That becomes a really interesting proposition that eliminates a whole class of, you know, componentry that organizations have been putting together into one, you know, easy to deploy solution.
So on the, I have the IO question, getting into the malware lab, what are the different methods or vehicles to get the malware in? Is it duplicating emails that have been coming into the company? Is it copying file shares? Is it sneaker netting folders over? So what, how do we do the IO? How do we get stuff in? And then on the outside, it sounds to me like Gazintu is one method and Gazautov is the Yara rules, but tell us kind of those two parts of the process.
Yeah, so obviously very important, because when you're integrating that with your, you know, usually very rich SOC workflow, and we really have hundreds of tools that the organization potentially could be putting together, moving from one side to another side, flexible connections become tremendously important. And so while we see many users using interface, like a web-based interface, and for a lot of things like dealing with the binary content, binary analysis, YARA matching, there is really no other solution other than ours that can best serve the purpose. We natively integrate with whatever a SIM source solutions a customer may have. And when it comes on the ingest, the customers can choose. Login into website, upload a file, use a REST API, do the automated workflow, and then use any of the number of the connectors that we have for the process. You want your ICAP content to be sent to Reversing Labs. You want all the email to be processed for Reversing Labs. SNMP connector can literally replicate a mailbox or the entire traffic moving in. And then we can go into sort of the native drivers for a host of things, from Exchange, Office 365 to OneDrive. And then for a lot of creative uses, being able to grab things from different sort of storage endpoints, S3, SMB, NFS, a lot of people are in the cloud, the entire CI/CD pipeline. So whether it's we are dealing with secure VPNs or we are dealing with development processes where we are analyzing containers, VMs or software installations, all that can be pushed through the very same workflow process, and effectively giving the analyst the ability to start looking at the data, making that a critical decision. Is this the type of a threat that we're going to do something about? Because think of it, like a threat with lots of alert could be just an adware sitting somewhere. You're not going to wake people up. You're probably not even going to re-image the machine for some of those threats. Or it could be something that you'll immediately kick off the network and push into the incident response process.
Did WannaCry kick off a concept of ransomware that's been evolving? Are there new models of a WannaCry since people have seen that as the first ransomware? Are we seeing with the unclean home computing where everybody's working from home now since COVID, where poor hygiene, are we seeing transformation in malware attacks based on SaaS and home computing, that kind of thing? What are we seeing out there today? And is it the supply chain? Where's the most malware attacks and the most risk?
Super interesting question. So there's a couple of things. And effectively, whatever you're reading in the papers, or if you just follow what government is doing, they're really narrowly focused on things that have been making the most damage. So ransomware, definitely a big thing. And then supply chain as being the atomic breach syndrome is the another thing. So we've been used to breaches to be company and company. When you get into the sort of solar winds, the indirection breaches, you're really talking about something that's a whole different level entirely that we really have not seen, discussed, and reacted to before. But to go back to ransomware, a lot of things have changed in the ransomware world. Ransomware has refocused from individuals. If you remember, a few years ago, it was really mom and pop get infected. They don't really know about computing. They may have some files that nobody knows the password to or one of a kind. Of course, don't back up. And now a son has to help out and spends $50, $100, initially credit cards. And then obviously now Bitcoin related payments, very cheap. Things have certainly upscaled to be attacking, and we've been seeing this for years, attacking hospitals, insurance companies, water utilities, pretty much anybody that has something that's of a time-sensitive nature. And that has become tremendously successful during the COVID, because so many people are at home and so many applications now can be accessed from the home. And a lot of these sort of unified client apps have from the documents stored in local machines to caches of the application locally. So you can imagine sort of ransomware making true mess. And then for those ransomware that can move through different methods and doesn't have to be SMB, just like in the WannaCry case, when you have a lot of these rich applications moving to home, effectively opening up a whole new level of networking for them to play with.
Like Dropbox and all the file sharing tools, everybody's sharing files over the internet, Google Drive. You've opened your computer up to the internet where your storage is partially local and partially remote. So you could probably infect other people easily that way. And then how many emails a day do we get where we trust someone, it's someone we trust, but they didn't know that their attachment was infected with some of the worst malware out there, whether it's a remote access Trojan or these ransomware
attacks. Yeah. But just also assume that VPN was in the past reserved for developers, executives, IT. Now everybody gets a VPN connection. And that sort of means policing those VPN connections that are used for everything. And sometimes even just the basic browsing has changed the game and literally opened up the door for, you know, a lot of these actors to have a go at.
Do you think that smart cities, and I wanted to ask you about operational technology attacks, OT attacks, like the one where one smart city, or maybe it's a dumb city, I don't know, but a city in Florida where I call it dumb in the sense that they got hacked. But the sure. minute you start Internet of Things and smart stuff, it seems to be the same word as either dumb or vulnerable. It doesn't have a firewall. It's got a back door. It's telnet. It's plain text. There's no SSH. The keys aren't managed. And suddenly the water supply is getting tainted.
Yeah.
This seems very new and very dangerous. Is this a new wave of malware? Is this just hackers finding new backdoors? And should smart cities be deploying malware net labs to get a step ahead of the threat?
Unfortunately, it's nothing new as a vector. And where things are different is that while historically the ransomware actors that are here have really done the business by looking for vulnerable RDP connections, sort of they're just doing sort of the basic math, like, oh, it's so expensive to pay a lot of these, you know, spam campaigns and try to phish things. But obviously, professional organizations that are just focusing on that, like the Emotet gang, and they cost money. With, you know, some of the IP profiling, if you hit, you know, the jackpot, you will get a direct connection to a machine. Now, historically, you were really focusing on a user, individual user, somebody that you could hurt them immediately, have a connection, pull out their credit card, or make them buy some Bitcoins and move forward. As their understanding of how US businesses work and how you could truly get a lot more money out of them, this is where you start seeing prowling for the very same vulnerabilities with small, underserved, underfunded organizations. And certainly any city and state organizations fall in that category. And likely here and there, someone's going to have unpatched Windows servers. So even they don't even have to be truly ignorant. They just need to be unpatched, you know, for a while, or patching didn't work, or, you know, all those problems you get with trying to keep up with the latest and greatest.
So Mario, my big question on your lab, I think everybody needs your malware lab, but who's the sweet spot? What kind of organization? Is it different verticals? Is it government agencies? What size best operates a malware lab? Who are you going after? Who do you think needs it the most?
I really believe everybody needs it that is implementing visibility or incident event response process. So pretty much anybody who has been tooling around or playing around with SIEMs, touching different TIP source solutions, figuring out the workflow, ticketing systems, that definitely need and can get, you know, a lot of value of something that easily plugs in and can give them that really wide visibility and assurance that every type of payload, every type of indicator have some kind of, you know, enrichment, you know, quickly, so that they could be assured, you know, that incidents are not dropping on the floor or wrong things being investigated, why the important things are being neglected. That's the calculation that we are looking for. Some organizations have many team members, obviously would help them a lot, while others may have very little, one effectively, especially those that have fewer have a bigger problem.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm just wondering, would you say a company with 1,000 employees or more, you know, is it, if they're already buying some threat feed or doing threat analysis, they probably would more intelligently focus on excellence and analyzing their own malware that's hitting them versus what's
Absolutely.
Going on
in the world? So if there are things that reversing labs can detect, you know, after all of their controls, they have a big problem because effectively their controls are failing. So if there are alerts that are never touched up because there is no other information so that analysts can figure out, is this false positive? Is this false negative? Should we do something about? They're failing. If there are alerts for which they have to close them because there was no additional information available, they're also failing because they can't really explain why something has been closed. And until organizations can really prove to their management, this is what a lot of teams are struggling to explain to the management, to those that are paying for this risk mitigation technique, and we don't need to talk about audits and regulatory compliance, that is a problem.
Can I take an example of, let's say I've got a file that I upload to VirusTotal and it runs it through 60 of the world's greatest antivirus scanners, and they all say, this is a good file, you can trust it. I put it in your malware lab. You're going to find something, I'm sure, that it's something 0 day, it's something nasty. Why is that? How come the 60 AV scanners can't catch what you can catch?
So they may or they may not. And so the next thing is really, what can you tell me about that, you know, piece of code? Can it be analyzed without actually running it? Can it be analyzed with running it in one of the number of, you know, different dynamic solutions that 3 Reversing Labs has at its disposal? Also, the important thing is, has that piece of code been seen somewhere? Have you ever seen it only on some, you know, random file share that's hosted in Russia? Or this is, you know, part of a driver or a firmware image or something obscure or potentially something very common. That's a weird file that just appeared in the latest, you know, Windows update. It's because Microsoft continually updates its core compilers, core CRP frameworks. There's always some, you know, novelty that triggers off some kind of alert warning, and now people need to look around and figure out for themselves, you know, what to do. Security products usually, when they don't detect it, they don't give you any information. Hey, you should forget about it. Just don't detect it. Just completely ignore it. And it's up to a person to figure out, hey, there must be a reason why am I looking at it. So do I just dismiss it? Or if I'm going to dismiss it, do I have additional information? Is this signed? What has the builder said about it? What kind of behaviors are associated with it? Anything that I've extracted from IOCs to strings from this particular the file, running or not running, has it been seen anywhere? These are all very important things that they could be provided quickly, make a very simple and comforting experience for the responders.
Now there's drive-by malware, people click links and they get infected, where it's somewhere out in the cloud, the infection starts off in a hyperlink. Can you help them with those? And then the other part is, I've heard between 1 to 10% of Fortune 1000 email that still gets past their spam filter contains a file attachment that they're not sure what it is at first, even though they ran it through a virus scanner. We're not there yet without you. I'm wondering, on both occasions, the unknown in an email and the unknown link, how can you help?
So, very good question. Links are obviously, for a lot of the email protections, in addition to the attachments, obviously the key elements that we are worried about. So being able to visit them safely, visit them in a way that you grab the content so you can analyze before you actually detonate them, and then deciding whether you detonate something, are very critical. And this is where Reversing Labs can help. And this is something that sounds very simple, but it's not normal part and parcel of many different systems. And usually organizations need to attempt to build it on themselves. So we can certainly help there. Now, other super important thing here is that people use different constructs. So if it's an email, it's using different malformations for MIME, or Base64 encodings, different ways to throw off, you know, standard parsers. Many of email parsers have been written years ago and can be easily owned by the attackers that way. And then we go into sort of different ways that we could package the payload so it looks as an embedded, you know, image or an archive that a security tool will not even carve out to analyze. But let's say Office will give you an extracted file, and maybe that file does not no longer have macros, but have embedded encoded URL somewhere, which then they just expect that the unwitting person will click on it. And for a lot of enterprises, that hit rate is at least 50%, because people assume if it got through my spam filter, it's probably good. We do have a huge, you know, social factor here. But when it comes to the complexity, I'm so happy that we were able to take down Emotet in the last, you know, few months, because Emotet was the most successful of the outfits that was providing services in being able to effectively place the second stage components onto the victims' machines. And one of the ways that they've done that was by investing in really, truly unique attack vectors. For example, and this is just one of their examples, was they would take Excel 4 scripting language, sort of in a binary way of representing the macros in Excel that, as far as we know, other than Reversing Labs, no other technology can, you know, decode, and actually embed URLs that would be shown to users and provide the connection to the next stage of attack. Something that for a lot of shops would really mean grab the Emotet payload, spin a VM, and then attempt to manually execute and follow what's happening. You're really talking about minutes, if not hours, just to get to the next stage, you know, of the attack. And here, reversing labs can instantly, you see the file, here's the payload, what do you want to do next with it?
Can I have your reversing lab malware labs up and running in a day, a week, a month? How long does it take to get deployed?
So it could be literally, you know, just minutes, standing up the, you know, containers in the VMs, if you want to have your own, or just giving you the credentials, you know, to get there.
That's fantastic. Mario, is there anything else you'd like to tell our viewers or listeners that we haven't covered today?
So I think interesting thing that we started talking about earlier on was how does the supply chain stuff comes into this? And so we started asking about email, and we had just last year, interesting situation coming with the FireEye announcing their breach. And days later, we heard that some company named SolarWinds has a problem. We don't know. There's something infected on there. In the tool, you know, kind of a couple of weeks later in a follow-up, Office 365 has a problem. And guess what? There were some other companies that deployed this SolarWinds that potentially had it running close to their source code systems. So we had Qualys and on of the companies worrying a lot of their buyers in terms of what's happening. This really means that the tool sets for increasingly more dedicated attackers, especially their state sponsored, is certainly growing. Organizations are training thousands of the hands of the keyboard ready to go in, steal, disable, destroy the equipment as necessary. And all of these steps are, you know, critical for their success. Ability to use phishing, ability to, as you mentioned, scan for IP addresses, look for RDP connections, get an access to a system in that way. Eventually looking for the build systems so they could potentially cuckold your software products to infect every one of your customers, really providing a wonderful, beautiful backdoor mechanism. And if you can imagine SolarWinds as a performance monitoring tool that goes on servers, have visibility and access throughout the customer network, you're effectively giving the keys to all sorts of...
Trusted by everyone.
And in that area, there is really no protection today. There is, everybody's talking about it. We have a solution. We should do something about it. And yes, to protect yourselves, you know, from some burst, and I'm talking about the attack, there's a lot of different places where protection needs to happen. By all means, you know, you need to have an EDR solution and be tracking IOCs and checking if an attacker is in your network and all of those things. But being able to inspect the software that you are downloading, buying, that comes in its natural form as a compiled code container VM, or that you are preparing to give to others, that in inspection needs to happen. And in this space, there's a massive gap. So most of the SDLC steps do not talk about it. They talk about code quality, vulnerability scanning, license inventory, but no one's saying, after I put it all together and ready to launch it, have I done my last step in a check? And this, if this happened in SolarWinds case, they would have been able to do stop ship. We've done a really nice, interesting blog report back in December, which allowed organizations to connect the first emergence of the malicious Orion driver in, I think it was like April of, you know, 2020, to roll it back to the first time that the attacker implemented a few functions to check how this is going to work out in October of, you know, 2019. So we're able to, with this methodology, by looking at, you know, function for function addition of the malicious intent, we were able to connect that timeline. But more importantly, this provides you a way to come up with checks that should allow both producers and buyers to say, hey, I have a red flag. I need a conversation. I need somebody else to tell me, is this normal or not?
So Mario, you just gave me the epiphany. You're saying don't just look at malware, look at trusted newly deployed VMs and executables that run in your environment that you trust. And you, for example, you would have found that backdoor vulnerability or problem in SolarWinds in advance of its exploitation.
Correct. We wouldn't know it would be the Russians, and the folks can read through the blog. We would just know something really weird is happening. And in this case, it was a difference from a patch to patch. All of a sudden, using the managed safe framework like .NET developer is doing everything possible to break it. by making direct unsafe calls to kernel, et cetera. And we've highlighted only six. There was a lot more, the warnings that all of a sudden happened. So, you know, from a patch to patch. When you speak to developers about this, it's like most organizations are going to say, hey, we would at least stop and say, hey, we need to talk to people. Somebody must have done a code review. And if you, you know, speak to, you know, to stakeholders for the code review process, they would say, I don't remember talking about this. This sounds literally weird. Let's call. What component? And then the developers say, I didn't write that code. I don't know how it ended up in the code repository. If the code repository was used, it didn't have to, because build process is something that uses code repository, uses your source of third-party components, and can produce and can do anything else that it wants to at the same time to produce you that final software application.
Wow. So the more complex the compilation is, especially with third-party tools, the higher probability that someone's going to sneak in a backdoor or a malicious piece of code in the compilation, and you're not going to see that because when you QA your product, it still functions as designed.
Correct.
But it's a ticking time bomb.
Correct. And SDLC tools do not analyze in a compiled code. You have a few companies that require object code. So effectively, they require a source code to analyze it, which is not it. You may not have it then. For an attacker who doesn't provide the source code, you're not going to get it. You'll get source code for trusted components, but not for untrusted. So you're not going to inspect it. So it's a no-win situation.
Wow. But you solved this. So
yes.
You're going to help us get one step ahead of the next threat and go into kind of the world of offensive cybersecurity with a best practice malware analysis model with a malware lab that actually works, designed by the market leader, by a black unicorn. But why go elsewhere, and why build it myself? And I think we should have it today, and it should almost be part of the training program for best practices in deploying secure operations, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. Thank you for the words of encouragement. We absolutely believe that folks need to fix their blue side of the house sort of response process, but then use that learning to apply it in the shift left world. The red side of the house can learn a lot and can benefit from what we are seeing in active exploitation to harden the applications that they deploy. And they're also making it, you know, a lot more difficult for the red teams to get through. After all, a simple fuzzing is a jackpot. People are done. Red teams really need to be, when the red teams start really working super hard to be effective in their breach, then we can say that we have moved the needle forward.
Do you want to send our viewers and listeners to any area on your website? Do you have a proof of value, proof of concept, a live demo of the malware analysis lab? Where should we send them for the next steps?
The easiest thing is simply just go to the reversinglabs.com. I know that, you know, our teams, you know, constantly adding, you know, different, you know, content. I know they're working on some really exciting video material. They're also preparing for the RSA conference. And we'll obviously have the links, you know, right from the homepage to the appropriate, you know, sources of that material.
Mario Folkson, the co-founder and CEO of one of my favorite companies, Reversing Labs, a black unicorn. Very cool company. One step ahead of the next threat. I'm really honored to have this hot seat with you once again, and I hope to see you again soon.
Gary, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and looking forward to our next conversation.
You've been listening to Cyber Defense Radio. Stay tuned next time for another amazing and informative episode. CyberDefenseRadio.com is proudly part of the Cyber Defense Media Group, where InfoSec knowledge is power.